I'd like to introduce Henry Farini, who is going to introduce
Dan Wilcox.
Right. Thank you, Amanda. Okay. Well, thanks for everyone coming out in this horrible weather, but we do need the water. I'm glad that Dan's here. He comes to Gloucester all the time. I don't think he's ever read at the... Well, actually, he read Monday at the Writer Center, so this is his second time now already. I'm glad that we're able to have him here with his friend Alan from New York. I wanted to call this thing Two Albanians, but Amanda said, no, maybe that's not a good idea. I like the Albanians with a Y instead of an I, Albanians. But anyhow... Dan seems to like be everywhere. I think I first met him at Vincent's maybe 85th or 90th or maybe 80th birthday party in Gloucester, and he's been documenting the poetry scene around here forever. So, and I have never read his work before. The last time he was in town, he laid one on me, and I wanted to read just one poem as a means of introduction from his book, Gloucester Notes. This poem has to do with Hartley and Helen Stein, and I think if everybody can see through time in this room here, they'll see Helen Stein around here. Because Helen and Vincent were friends, and Vincent used to frame stuff for Helen, and she was over here often. And so I like the connection between Hartley and Helen's portrait, which probably everybody's seen over at the Cape Ann, the museum. Marsden Hartley's eyes. And as Lester Young would say, I have nice eyes for this poem. Marsden Hartley's eyes stare out of Helen Stein's portrait into this gallery ringed by his portraits of boulders of Dogtown. The paintings, mostly red or green, but always blue, like his eyes that stared outward when the oils were wet, where the granite sat against the sky. And that was a poem at the Cape Ann Museum. That's a wonderful portrait, Stein's portrait of Hartley. That's right as you turn around, as you come up the stairs. So with that, Dan Wilcox.
Thank you. All right, yeah, thank you. This is for your taping, I suppose, right?
Yeah, that's okay. It. So you can sit down or stand, yeah, whatever.
I'm a performance poet, and with the three guys from Albany, that was our group, so I'm used to standing. So when I sit down, I feel like I'm not reading or anything. I'm only going to read one poem on this thing. Everything's on paper. But I do want to emphasize the connection between Albany, New York, and Gloucester, Massachusetts. And there's lots of them. I have personal connections, too. Actually, I learned of Gloucester and I learned about Gloucester from Bill Dugan and Gene Dugan. Many of you know them. I was married to Bill's sister Mary. So that's what brought me over here. So, but last year, in reference to a question from a friend of mine about whether Gloucester was north or south of Albany, I checked the latitude. And here's an amazing thing. If you look at a map, you see they're pretty much on the same level. They're only separated by 0.0367 degrees. Now, I tried to find out how many miles that was, but you need to know trigonometry and logarithms, and that's where I stopped. So, that's the difference in between north and south, and Albany is actually a little bit more north. So that's the difference in north to Gloucester. So Gloucester is at 42.6158 degrees north, and Albany is at 42.625 degrees north. So it's pretty close, I guess. So we're very close, and I come over here quite a few times a year. For my soul. That's what I'm over here for. you know. But I realized today, I was looking on Facebook, and May 4th, 1970, Kent State. So I was in the Army at the time. Now, that's a whole other story I can tell you about what happened that day. But this is, I wrote this in 2010, and it's called 44,000, May 4th, 2010. The scientists who study dreams, the oneurologists, tell us we dream every night, many times a night. But is it one long dream, like a Fellini movie playing all night? Or a string of Bugs Bunny shorts? In 60 years, in 21,900 nights, I have watched 65,700 movies if I dreamed only three times a night. And how many movies would you miss if, say, you were in Ohio in Kent State, or in Mississippi at Jackson State in May 1970, if you were Sandra Shorer, Jeffrey Miller, William Schroeder, Alison Krauss, if you were Philip Lafayette Gibbs, if you were James Earl Green, if you were 17 or 19 or 20 or 21 years old, if your dreams were punctured by a bullet. Two lifetimes ago, dreams not forgotten, dreams lost, movies missed, more than dreamed in a lifetime. 44,000 more than they dreamed in a lifetime. So, Kent State. So, we're going to get a lot happier after that, folks. It is not going to be that grim. So, I'd like to, since I mentioned, talked about Albany, I think I'll do my introductory poem that I like to do a lot when I visit other places that are not Albany, or when I visit other places that are Albany. Three guys from Albany, our goal was to read poetry in all the Albanys in the United States. So far, we've gotten to 13 out of the 18. So this is actually about a poetry reading series that was done very early in Albany, New York, at the QE2 by my friend Tom Nattel, who started the poetry series there. And what happened was, on successive Saturdays in the summer, we had featured readings, and the readings were generally two or three poets from the university setting. And then on the last night, there was a reading by people who had been reading in the open mic up to that point that Tom selected. And I noticed an interesting thing, that the people from the university read only at, they only went to the reading that they read at, whereas many of the open mic people from the community came to other readings. So this is a poem that's titled, Where Were the Professors? And it's dedicated to all those academic poets who only show up at poetry readings when they are paid. These are all real people in here. When Charlene opened the doors and the poets charged in, fighting for the bottom of the list, when you stood here off stage, sweating, shaking, and realized you'd had too many beers already, when the podium shook and blinded by the light, you wondered, is anyone out there? And a beer bottle hit you, where were the professors? When Matt Kelly confronted the homeless and greeted the ghosts of his buddies right here on this stage, when Tanya read a poem to her father, Siobhan a poem to her mother, when Mary Panza's curses made cocks fall like dried leaves all along Central Avenue, where were the professors? When John Drucker's landlord heard him all the way across town with the microphone off, when Carl lit a candle before an icon and pondered death in his Russian soul. When Tom fashioned tiny warheads into suppositories for the generals and the politicians. And I called for the death of Richard Nixon. Where were the professors? When we read poems about anything, including grandchildren and the heat. When we argued on stage, off stage, along the bar, in the toilet, out the door, into the gutter until morning, and a police horse shit in our faces. When our notebooks dissolved in beer, and we lost the best poem we ever wrote. Where were the professors? So. I have to pay tribute to Vincent here. I actually took some photos of Vincent at one of those birthday events. I don't know which one it was, back with my old black and white film. I actually wrote to him a couple times, and he has this marvelous little book, Deluxe Daring, here, with these drawings by Jane Robbins. Yeah. And I looked in this book when I bought the book, and there was this marvelous drawing. I don't know how much you can see it, of this angel. All right, you can tell he's an angel because he's got wings, and you can tell it's a he because he's nude and his little dick is hanging down out there. Actually, this is the poem that was originally written on there. So I wrote a poem about that, and I actually sent it to Vincent, and he wrote back to me about it. So I'm going to read that poem to honor the space here. And it's called Angels, from Jane Robbins' drawing. Oh, and it has a little epigraph that I translated. It's the epigraph is in English, "Birds sing when angels masturbate." And it's a quotation from a 3rd century theologian, Onan of Alexandria. When Michael the archangel flies, his wings push, pull the wind. His feathered flight path draws a question mark. Is he nude? Does his angel dick hang down, point longingly to earth? When Gabriel announced to Mary she would be the mother, was he a nude angel? With his dick hard and straight, throbbing for the Lord's future? So, if angels don't wear robes, I want my naked guardian angel to be female, with a pretty face, perky breasts, and downy feathers for her pubic hair. All right, so, angels, okay. So, you know, I had an interest in Olson for a long time before I met Mary. And, you know, when I found out her brother had just moved to Gloucester. You guys may have been living in Rockport at one point just before that. It was, right, 77, 78, something like that?
To Gloucester in 76.
Okay, so, yeah. So I said, Gloucester? Gloucester? I know about Gloucester. You know, only from books, only from Maximus poems and stuff. So this is a poem, actually, it was written a few years later when we lived in Yonkers, and I was walking to the train to go to work through fog. And it references a quote from Olson called The Seedling of Morning from Maximus' first book. This is Alba. Wrapped in the gray day, morning glories drop silent spent blossoms. My reflection forms and breaks on the wet asphalt. A nearsighted morning of feathered skies, trees, wet streets fade into haze like distance in a painting. Beyond the bridge on the river, three dim white ceramic ducks carve silver wrinkles on glass. The seedling of morning is the perfect time for study. When Olson read his dictionary, when the crescent moon and single star form an emblem for the flag of a new nation or state of mind. So, so Gloucester notes, as Henry showed you, and he read that wonderful poem. And thank you to Peter, who actually put that poem up on Enduring Gloucester when the book first came out. And then just last week also put up one of the Hopper painting, which maybe I'll change my set list and read that too. So this just came out from Foothills Publishing in the end of 2015. I have copies over there, $10. And then I also have other books, chapbooks from Boundless Abodes of Albany that I just read that was published by Alan Casline, who'll be reading with me. That's there too, and a couple others, including the cheapest. I always wonder about this. Maybe I shouldn't put the cheapest book out there because that's what people will buy, right? But I have a little pamphlet called Baghdad, Albany, and Other Peace Poems, and that's only $1. So it goes from 10 down to $1. All right, so I'm going to read a few poems out of this and then a few others, and that'll be it. Because I don't want to read too many because it's only a little book, and I want you to just have enough interest so you'll buy the book. Right? I mean, that's what it's about, right? So I think probably the first poem I ever wrote about Gloucester, and I'm not sure that this is true, but I'm guessing it is.
Close enough.
Right. Who's going to know, right? Is this one about going to Dogtown with the Dugans, you know, in one fall day. And this is called Spiritual Power, the Babson Boulders, Dogtown. These rocks, boulders in Gloucester, in the old deserted Gloucester of Dogtown, carved with cliches, industry, study, be on time. Even in the ancient wind and rain, these rocks, like the God of the Catechism, have been here, will be here, when these hands and minds are gone, as these frail leaves falling from the trees will be gone beneath the winter's snows, even when they are smooth again and silent. So at some point, those rocks will be worn away, I suppose. And we come over with my family, and there were five of us, so we couldn't stay at their house for more than a weekend, you know. But we loved being here, so we would rent places in Gloucester, over by Plum Cove, for a couple summers. We had that marvelous little place in Maryland's there next to the church. And then further up Thatcher Road, just over the line in Rockport, we found a nice little place. We went for many years, for a week. And then I said, week's not enough. I got to be here 2 weeks. So we went 2 weeks. So we saw my kids grow up here. This is about my son, Jack. I have a photograph that actually this shows too. It's called Jack Sketching. Jack sketches a thousand-armed figure at the Tibetan Museum with a thick, soft, black artist pencil in his pocket notebook like the one he gave me. I see him again at 6 years old, lying on the dock in Gloucester, sketching boats with a fist full of red, blue, yellow, and green-colored pencils in a pocket notebook that I gave him, too big for his little pocket. Then I towered over him, paused to look at his work. I pause now as he towers over me. That's what happens, right? They grow up. I think I'll read the Hopper painting one.
Do it.
Okay, you like that one. Which is interesting because the painting is not about Gloucester at all. I think it was done in North Truro. The painting is by Hopper's called Rooms by the Sea, 1951. But you all know he did a lot of paintings in Gloucester, too. The funny thing about this painting is when we first moved into our house in Albany in 87, we had some artwork, but we didn't have a lot, and we didn't have anything big enough to put over the mantelpiece. But the Albany Public Library had this program where you could borrow these reproductions of paintings for like 3 months at a time or something. So one of the ones we got was the Hopper painting. So I had that and staring at that in my living room for a long time. The Hopper painting. I get up and go to the window. The sea is right outside. There is no beach, only the sea. The white is not foam, it is light. The sun reflecting from the high side of the waves, while the deep part is blue, bluer. Where the black, blue meets the white sky is the same line as the wall that meets the ceiling. I sit on the red couch and think of immensity, of infinity, of the edges between the door and the sea. The two pieces of the sky, the doorknob, the latchwork of the jamb. I walk to the window, around the wall to the door, step into the light, watch the shape change. If the door closes, I will fall into the sea. So if you look at the painting, it's really a very cubist painting of angles and stuff, and it's an odd kind of piece. I'll do one more from the book, and this will be, this is one we had a Russian teacher, exchange teacher stay with us in Albany, and she came from Nizhny Novgorod, which used to be Gorky, but it's like in the middle of Russia someplace. And she said to us she'd never seen the ocean. Whoa. I said, okay, got to take you to the ocean. So drove over with her for a weekend over here. It was cold. It was sort of like today, in a way. This is called The Cold, Clean Sea. Along the empty autumn beach, we take off our gloves to dip our fingers in the surf, to taste the cold, clean sea. The cold sea that hides all kinds of debris. The clean surf of a great trash heap, a shroud for the bodies of men and fish, a pit for the forgotten, the lost, the intentional and the unintentional, for the long misplaced, for trinkets and bottles and cans, for lumber and rope and line, for glass and plastic, for things of the sea and things of the land, a great pit, distilling, fermenting, dissolving, composting, like memories of forgotten parties, foreign languages never learned, lost and forbidden vocabularies. When we taste the sea, we taste all that has cooked in its cauldron. Taste it. Does it need more salt? All right, I'm going to do just two more. These are ending poems, poems about endings, I suppose. End of the reading. Not, I don't want to get too, you know, I get too serious about all this. This is a poem I read the other night here at the open mic, but it's new, and I like reading out new stuff. And there's only a couple people have heard me, and one's not paying attention. So this poem is a little piece is based on an article I was reading in American Poetry Review. The title of the article was "Decomposition as a Spiritual Value in Poetry." And, you know, it's one of those type of articles. And but they so well, I do read, but you know, whatever. But it cited an article in a journal, and the title of the journal is "Compound Chemistry." Do you have? No, you don't. No. I was wondering. I've never yet had anybody say, "Oh yeah, I get that all the time." So, anyways, the article in Compound Chemistry talked about the reason why libraries and a home library or used bookstores smell the way they do is because of the decomposition of the chemicals that are used in making books, that are in the books. And so as they decompose, they hear about it. But, you know, there's a certain set of chemicals that's, that are involved. So some of which are mentioned in the poem. So that's what this is called. Oh, and another little story to go along with that. My son and his daughter, she's 14. She's a poet. Went to a used bookstore cafe, breakfast cafe, in Easton, Pennsylvania. And so it smelled like the cafe and it smelled like the old books. And when they walked in, they both said the same thing to each other at the same time. Hey, this smells like Grandpa's house. It smelled of bacon and old books. So decomposition. The books dissolve from my shelves in a hint of almond with benzaldehyde, sweet notes of toluene and ethyl benzene, 2-ethylhexamyl, a floral fragrance. I smell gauloise lit at a cafe table, espresso spilled on the corners, bacon, the sea salt curling the edges of pages. Books are a soup, a paprika, a goulash, anointing my living room. Quotes, footnotes disappearing, dust of trees. What I breathe in, breathe out at last. Yeah. All right, so the last one is along those lines, about the end, is from a chapbook I did a few years ago called Poeming the Prompt. And these were poems selected from, I actually did one of those silly write a poem a day from the prompts things. And at the end, I looked at it and I realized that a lot of the poems I was writing about were about the prompts. About the idea of a prompt. So I collected them in a little chapbook. But this one did not come from a prompt. It did not come from any, well, it came from a prompt. It came from the prompt of our lives, you know? So this is called At the End. And of course, I'll end with this. When the heart stops at the end, the breath stops. The words end. Poems don't stand around the bed. Instead, it's people standing like poems. When the heart stops, hearts keep beating. Those we made, those we have touched. Keep beating for us when the words stop. So thank you. Thank you, Gloucester. Thank you, Henry, Amanda. Thank you for the people of Gloucester, really, for, you know, when I first came over here, there was no Gloucester Writers Center, you know, when there was a great history of writing in Gloucester, but there was no thing that people went to and had these things. And this is what? There was you know, Garrett's bookstore and things like that. There was these kind, but it's nice to have an institution that, yes, that springs up out of the community, out of the people giving you money and making it happen. So I think these things are important to institutionalize them in a way that makes it real for the community. So I really applaud all you people. That's why I support you guys. So thank you. Thank you. So at this point, I want to introduce my friend, my co-reader, Alan Kazline, who is another poet of Albany. More than that, he is one of these people who makes things happen in the community and creates events. And he's been doing this a long time, even before he got to Albany. He was telling me today that this overarching organization that he has called the Root Drinker Institute. Alan's very concerned with things like watersheds and things, which is where that comes from. And he studies those things, and he's a great defender of watersheds. So this overriding thing is the Root Drinker Institute, which has existed for a long, long time. Right, Alan? I mean, I don't even know how long. But
1975.
Wow. That's a lifetime for lots of people. There you go. See that? Yeah. So, yeah, and that's what he does. But out of that has sprung a number of things once he landed in Albany. He runs Benevolent Bird Press, which published this chapbook, which is only $5. Okay, $5. Bountiful Abodes of Auburn. And this is sort of my greatest hits. This was published in 2010, but it's sort of like all my, and he picked them out. He did a great job. I couldn't have done a better job. Well, yeah, we sort of, but no, so.
You're one of my, when I try to talk to some of the other people, you're one of the people I point to is, look at Dan Wilcox. You know, he sat at his kitchen table and he went through a bunch of poems and
right.
Said yes and no.
Yes, and no, and that's it. That's it. But he publishes lots of the other poets of Albany. I characterize them as unknown poets because that's my claim to fame with my photos. But, you know, they're known in the community. And so he just gets a whim and he decides to publish a little chapbook of these people's poetry. And they don't come to him. He comes to them. And he also runs a regular series at the Pine Hollow Arboretum. It's a marvelous place in Albany with all kinds of different trees. I mean, I'm an urban guy. You see one tree, you see them all. But this place is all different kinds of trees, you know, like, wow. You know, there they all are. And it's a great location, but they also have a nice little meeting place. And Alan's been running a poetry series there where he features a poet. And then, in the grand tradition of Albany, we have an open mic along with it. So that's been going on for a number of years. So he's one of these movers and shakers that makes things happen in Albany. So please welcome my friend Alan Kaslan.
Thank you, Dan. Yeah, I usually said I'm a poet of the Normanskill watershed, not of Albany.
Okay.
Well, that's okay. I just correct people on that part. This is like my drum set, you know, I like set up around me.
You standing? Okay.
As long as I'm heard. Okay. Let me know if I am too quiet. Okay, so I have like a few poems, I think 18. They aren't all mine. Oops. I'm also going to read some Olson, Charles Olson, and a Linda Parker poem. But the bookends are going to come from this set of poems here called 64 Changes. This is a book I worked on for about 30-some years because if you're familiar with the I Ching, if you throw coins or through some other method get a hexagram, so I'd only write a poem if I threw the coins for it. So there's some cases where there might be one or more poems for the same hexagram, so I just kept them all in here. But so what I did is I threw the coins for both myself and for this writing center. So I'll start with the hexagram that I got for myself, and we get at the end, I'll let you know what it said about this place. So, this is hexagram 27. Spirit to serve alone helps the world. The spirit to serve alone helps the world. Note the way to self-improvement. Seek good, rid yourself of evil. A true kind heart is recognized. A few leaves start all the foliage falling. Foggy mornings give way to blue sky. Chill air slows the sun from overwarming skin. A light breeze dries out the soil. The water in the yard carries traces of the sky. So my memories, and I was finding today as my wife Jennifer Pierce and I were driving around, tracing back my life in Gloucester from 30 years ago, and that's how long it was that I was active in this area. And it's sort of like, you know, the Grateful Dead band, how you're supposed to, many people follow them around and would try to go to as many concerts as they could or actually live their life as followers. But my theory was that I would only see the Grateful Dead once, which I did in 1974 in Winterland in San Francisco for their New Year's performance. So that's like my doing it once, then I don't have to do it all these other times. And my experience in Gloucester was beautiful and intense, and it kind of came to an end that was a natural end. And like the Grateful Dead, it was like, that's enough. So me coming here tonight is kind of opening the door again to saying, okay, Gloucester can have new life. But meanwhile, there's this Gloucester in my memory, you know, which includes Olson in my memory. And that's the work I'm going to be pulling from tonight. So, I skipped a poem, but that's good. I'll get back to it after this one. All right, I dreamed last night of the circling of stars. I dreamed last night of the circling of stars, my dream telling me I had it wrong, showing me first the constellations, cryptic, marked off as zodiac, slowly turning with my view straight ahead, like the axle on the cosmic wheel, with the North Atlantic in front of me, looking out from Gloucester. I was almost Maximus looking out, more looking at Olson looking, and then looking myself along the line of sight to the sea for what stars were rising and falling. A viewmaster view of the turning wheel, or a child's secret code with two alphabets moving around a small circle inside a larger, A to M is M to Z, 26 languages, 26 codes for keeping secrets. The presence controlling my dream had me gaze to see the whole sky, find a single light among the many, Polaris, the axle point, center pole for the circling stars, and I saw the turning around. Another presence came and spread out my star chart with ink smudged, the diagrams and words bleeding as if it had been soaked, which I saw it was beginning to be soaked by time. What am I destinies still unknown? I cried again for my friend who drew out the chart and told me once, you speak of local, specific, change, but if those three are not first self and that self keeping still, then energy and eagerness are merely some sparks on the circumference. Sparks on the circumference. Yes, I have learned to center the universe. What I didn't know, such a fool, may these dreams come to tell me. Horizon is not a line. Horizon is also a circle. Turn around. Circle as the stars circle. Look in all directions. Each shows horizon, the boundaries of a great circle, as well as the sky. This next poem is called Sea Raven, and this is a poem that I wrote for the friend that's mentioned in the other poem, Linda Parker. And she lived, as many of you may have known her, or some of you may have known her, she lived in Gloucester. And this particular poem, when I came back to visit her, I found it. She had cut it out and like had left it up on the wall in the room. So the poem had spent more days in Gloucester than I have, but it was, to me, that was like Olson's apartment, so to me that had meaning. So Sea Raven, black-eyed Sea Raven floats beyond the fleet of small boats in gray lapping fog, the sea everywhere. Woman in a pink dress sits waiting on the docks for work to begin, Shops line the small town streets. Twin mirrors, sky and sea. a ghostly crane balanced on one long stick leg, matched by a wobbly image at the other end of the post, ceaseless like a great ring of pure and endless light. Rows of dock posts, rolls of water posts, reflections. And this is one of Linda's books, someplace I showed it. This one, Sea Raven, well, was earlier. If you look in the front, you can see one of these poems. It says Root Drinker. One of these poems was published in Root Drinker. But this one here, Graphite, is divided into sections. And I think, you know, in the way that everything is revealing, I think the way that this poem traces appears in here, she has sections, book 6, book 7, book 8. Well, book 7 is one poem. And this is what it is. Where did the crane step for Alan and me? Water traces, where are they? Water traces, who walks on water traces? Where are they? Water traces. So I also brought some of my bezoars that I got in those days. There was an exchange, Root Drinker exchange with bezoar. So this one here is there's more than one in here, June 1977. Cast in order of appearances, Vincent. I get tongue-tied. Ferreni, right? Ferreni, yep. Chris Torrance, Maria Gittin, Bobby Bird, David Gittin, Michael Rumaker, and a special guest star. Yep. Okay. All right. All right. So I can go back to the poem that I was going to start with. Because what I'm going to, and that's sort of, there's a little bit of the historian like that. I am a historian, and that's what the poem is about. And the next few poems are going to be directed at the Algonquin myths that you find in Maximus and what that meant to me. But this one's called The Mystery of the Ghost-Haunted Hills. And it mentions Normanskill, which is my river and watershed. The historian walks the land that ceases to be. At dusk, his dusty path presses on bones. The earth is a graveyard. But if one ghost spoke to another, who would hear? And here's a quote from William Cullen Bryant, Forest Hymn. These lofty trees wave not less proudly that their ancestors molder beneath them. Breathe in a thousand souls, breathe out correspondingly. Heraclitus finding the familiar hidden, taking what's ordinary without pause. Take the ordinary without pause. Your footstep in a river, your footstep in the Normanskill. Achievements remain, a man has lived, writes Arthur P. Gregg in his local history book, Old Heldenberg. Of the Colonel Abraham Wemple, Wemple's homestead given to the reservoir that collects water from the upper Normanskill. And this quotes Gregg, climb the hill that rose behind the great house and part the grass in search of the brown gravestones that once marked the last resting place of the great leader, but not even a trace you will find. It is for me to make the climb, or the one like it, turning old with an altered gait, when nothing can be exactly repeated. History tells someone was paid off, gave up land for coin as the reservoir fills, water flows without piling up. Not even you will find the trace, but perhaps one ghost whispered the tale to another. So, in Maximus from Dogtown 2, I'll just go to, there's a spot here where Olson is sort of listening, I guess, sources, and he goes, "And Algonquin, he with the house on his head, she who lusted after the snake in the pond." So that heaven is a house on your head. Something that affected me, and I've been sort of puzzling over it, I don't know, 35 years or so. Still not, I mean, what I've thought about it has changed. But this is one of the oldest publications I was involved in 75, I believe. And so there's this poem. "Left my room, headed south. I'll find a bed of grass to rest my soul. Thumb out. It doesn't matter to me that you're not going anywhere. A stranger will open the door and let you ride. So what's on your mind? I'm carrying my house on my head." The strangers all said, "I'm trapped, son. I'm trapped in this trap I cannot see. And if you tell me, you aren't allowed to ride with me." So I kept my mouth shut. First wisdom. Walking along a roadbed, perfect round moon in the sky, the ear of stars listening to me, listening to them, frogs awake in the light, singing awake the spring. So this is the Algonquin Legends, Charles E. Leonard. It's like someplace I have it written down. It's like 1888 or something, but it's the book that Olson used. Like I said, it took me a period of time to, I kept running across this, you know, heaven is a house, in the Maximus poems, but I had not systematically gone page by page through it. But this is where I'm going to read some Olson. There's like three of them, and they're actually three of the Algonquin myths that that he took and presented. One, I like to say this is one of my favorite Olson poems. "He who walks with his house on his head is heaven. He who walks with his house on his head is heaven. He who walks with his house on his head." So that's one myth. This one. Two. "She who met the serpent in the pond, the adulteress, who met the serpent in the pond and was kissed by him, was wrapped in his coils. She had to die if she could not pass by fucking the poison on. If her husband could not fuck with her and die by fucking, she could not get rid of the poison after she was fucked with the king of the pool." And the third one. "The woman who said she went out every Sunday and walked right through the rock of the mountain. Now on the other side, she said she was fucked by the mountain. All that was her joy. Every day of the week, and she was the happiest of the tribe. And that was her explanation given by her and why. And that was how it was. That was how it was she was so happy." And those are actually November 1962. So, of course, there is a longer version about the heaven is a house on the head. Then, and this is it in Maximus. But I'm not going to read that. Instead, I'm going to read you my version. There we go. Okay. Was a good deed, not worried to be mixed in the affairs of two who danced a tree to fall, a desired raccoon high in the birch. They were shaman to dance around, circled, each journey wearing their steps deeper into the ground. There's a new way to cut down a tree, the raccoon skin for me and the meat and the rest for you. So the dancing man and woman agreed. After he felled the tree, the woman tanned the skin. Pulowe set off again, carrying it. He went a ways until his path crossed that of a man carrying a house on his head, a large birch wigwam of many rooms. Pulowe was wary, but as they sat and shared smoke, he became at ease with the stranger. Affairs did not seem mixed, for as he told the story of how he gained the raccoon skin, the Pilwi Man So, or man who belonged somewhere else, anxiously bid to buy it, offering possession after possession, till at last the house, which was accepted. The house, as light as a basket, Pilwi set off, carrying his new dwelling on his head. As shadows lengthened, he came to a deep, pure spring. The hollows hilled were covered with ash and birch. Here he decided he would make his place and set the house on the ground. He entered and found many rugs and furnishings, beautiful tools, baskets and bowls. More rooms branched off in all directions. In one he found a very fine bed covered with a white bearskin. He crawled under the white cover and slept a peaceful night. In the morning he awoke to wonder. Above his body hung in the house rafters a feast of tasty foods, baskets of berries, mushrooms, groundnut roots, dried corn wove by husks in hanging branches. He cried out to see such beneficial substance. The white bear skin melted and flowed away. He reached his hands up in joy. They turned to wings, and he flew up to the food. The bearskin ran away because it was the snow of winter. His landing showed him the food was the early buds on the birch. He was a partridge. As his kind did, he had sheltered under a snowdrift. Now came out to greet warm green spring. Okay, so this is a poem that came after that one, and my friend Ken Warren, the late Ken Warren, published this in House Organ. It's called Not Understanding Charles Olson, which I definitely should come to Gloucester to proclaim that. Pilwi Mansoin, man who belonged somewhere else, a stranger. In Onondaga myth, the first who died, gust of winds, was reborn as fertile woman, visited by a nocturnal stranger, none other than the ruler of the winds. She gave birth to twins, gods crossed from myth to myth, no doubt there. Different names, the same story, it is the teller who sees each differently. Was Pilwi Mansoin the ruler of the winds? What is his other name? Why the raccoon skin so important? Olson's man with the house on his head is heaven. Must be this first guy. Surely he didn't give his house up without an alternative creation to save or to build or to move the story along. Why anxious? Did Pilwi Mansoin go back to speak with the two shaman? Are the raccoon's bones also important? Did Olson recognize the stranger? Do I choose to follow the man who belongs somewhere else, to see where he is going, to see where he comes from? What if he notices me following him? So here's another Algonquin legend from Charles C. Leland. It's called Find the Rabbit in This Story. But, persisted the wildcat, why are your feet, the soles of your feet, yellow, even like a rabbit? That is because I have been preparing some tobacco and I had to hold it down with my feet. Truly, I needed to hold it down with my feet. I needed both my hands to work with, so the tobacco stained them yellow. Then the wildcat suspected no more, and the doctor put the salve on his wound so he felt much better. So I have a few more myths moving to different parts of the world. This one is a Finger Lakes creation tale. Mother Turtle and Grandfather Carp were together in the beginning. They named Lobo. They named Trout. Bear came upon them. Let us have Bear help us create this world, said Grandfather Carp. Fine, said Mother Turtle. Bear, what is the name of that green frog? That is Green Frog. What of the black bird with red on the wings? That is Red-winged Blackbird. They all thought this so funny, they laughed till their bellies hurt. Oh, Bear, said Mother Turtle, you are very good at the naming of things. Yes, said Bear, but I have to go. Before I do, I shall name my kindred. No, said Grandfather Carp, still laughing. That is Brown Bear and that is Black Bear. Delightful, said Bear, exactly as I would. So there's a note with this one. As Stephen Levinkowski might point out, carp are not native to the Finger Lakes region. However, Grandfather Carp was present and involved in the naming of things back at the time of creation. He did not stay around and return to Asia by swimming through the mysterious Spelunken, also known as the Doorway to Infinity, found at the bottom of a deep hole in the water of Cannondice Lake. The lake had a different name at the time. This next one is a myth of a Bear Hill, and that's B-A-R-E. One of the things I do is I'm one of the principals of putting together a poetry and poetics conference that we hold in the Finger Lakes every year, and one of our events is to go out and explore the area and go and see various things. There are like two different emergence sites where the Seneca Indians came from another world to this world. There's also a burning spring where there's natural gas coming up through the water and you can light it on fire. So that's like another place. This year we're going to a big hole that we're going to get to look down into. So I'm not sure. I'll report back on that, I guess. But last year we went to Bear Hill, and Bear Hill is one of the emergence places the Senecas have. But it has a myth about why it is like bear on top, which is still true. There are a few trees, but it's mostly grassland. So I wrote this poem to that myth, and apparently my friend Stephen Levandowski told me it was accurate, which is from him that's great praise because he, as Jennifer knows, he's kind of short with his praise. All right, a bear hill. Treeless because of the damage done by a gigantic snake. A snake that shouldn't have been there, except for the mercy, or maybe more accurately, curiosity of a young boy who saw the colorful snake one day near shore in the cloudless lake water and took the small snake home. The boy showed capacity to care for the creature, catching beetles, flies, slugs, and small frogs. Bill Gelders thought it was good that the young learn of responsibility. The problem was not with the boy, but with the snake's ravenous appetite, an appetite that needed to be satisfied. So the snake began to grow and grow. As the snake grew larger, the boy increased the amount of food. When it was too much for the boy, his parents took over the feeding. whole deer now went down the snake's gullet. The parents and other adults in the village began to worry, and some began to plan to move away from their longtime hilltop village. The snake got an appetite for human flesh and twined itself around the village and killed everyone except a brother and sister. In a dream, the boy's aim was true. Awake, he shot as if in his dream, aimed his arrow to kill. The snake twisted and turned, destroying the trees at the top of Bear Hill before he fell dead into the lake. According to Seneca legend, this is why Bear Hill is barren and treeless. There was no renewal for this land. The bad magic is too big. Okay, just a few more. This next little section is dedicated, I guess, to Wa Wei, who's a woman poet friend of mine. I heard her read, and instead of saying the next poem, she would say, "My next lesson is," and go on to there. So I thought I would have a few lesson poems and maybe break a little bit from the format so far. The first one's called Winter Garden. Wet snow covers over and sticks. After vegetable garden uncovered by warm spill, measuring what was still green, charred onion tops, bok choy, broccoli. New social movement for the ages, adapters. Doubt we are in a simple cycle. What to know down here on the earth when it counts? I left my fall crop in place, harvested a bowl of leaves in mid-December, turnip, beets, cabbage, broccoli. You can eat the leaves. Doubt there will be any growth in temperature range 40 degrees and lower. Interested in the spring when freeze gives way to warmth. Not sure what I am doing here, just looking at my garden and thinking this late fall crop. Put a bag in the refrigerator, cut up and mixed with rice, tasty in mid-January. Seems fairly certain autumn weather will be trending warmer, and the adapters will notice. Still welcome the snow, need moisture, dormant rest. Big question for the spring, when do we turn under and plant the new? Vegetables under snow cover, if they live, will start again and be early to make their seed. Adapters harvest seed, outside snow is light. High up in silver maple, I see an old broken branch hanging there, drying out, two-toned white on top. Next one's called Finding. Doug drives the Ford 9N, pulls a hay wagon, that's good. Doug drives the Ford 9N, pulls a hay wagon. Rebecca bales up ahead. I throw bales on the wagon. Dust blows into Rebecca's eye. She wipes with her arm, dislodges and loses her contact. Damn, my contact is gone. We'll never find it again in this field. No, wait, let me look. I am good at finding things. Come off my perch on the wagon bed, walk over, kneel. Look at the stubbles of cut hay, reach out and find her contact. Finding does not involve looking. Rather, it is a particular kind of quiet. When something is lost, if you still open awareness, scan where you are, then quiet yourself more. No loss, no object of desire. Reach out for what was lost. Travel to the right place and pick it up. Not thrown splatter on the wall of the hive mind. Not load up query in your search engine. We all live in information overload. Finding is the skill, the talent for this era. True story. I am good at finding. My wife will verify. Uncanny.
Gossip quote said, what? Do not seek, I find.
Yeah, right. Lost art. Harry Brown used to move a lot, and Jack Clark was always updating Al Glover to Harvey's new address. Also, when those poets in that time went to visit someone or went on vacation or got a temporary gig, it was vital that news of the address change reached with timing so letters could arrive when the poet was present. Too soon or too late destroyed the symmetry. You can say this is a lost art that nobody would miss, but I don't think so. It is about timing. Nowadays, we have program sorting, human rhythm ignored. I know I can reach thousands. Do I really reach them? You might be surprised to know it is a question that haunts me. If I got a letter from a friend somehow out of head of me, that changes the world not quite so unknown, my day not quite so forgotten. Last one in this section. We know Olson loved the speed, but could he have made books or poems in the email age? Left with the immediate, I expect he would adapt, so to speak. He'd be thinking how to avoid pitfalls, would join this conversation. We also know he was so particular in spacing words on the printed page and getting his publishers to exactly do the same. Could he work with a computer program that presumed and changed content and form, or throw the damn thing out the window? Some of another era don't want to leave their typewriter, kind of a squared fitted page to me. Biggest anger point is horizontally of trying to scribe text in word processing. As a publisher, I can't handle curved lines either unless it is a photographic reproduction. From curved line original, some tech geek will tell me there is a program for that. I say I'd rather have a marked off stick than a ruler. Okay. So back to the end of the book. So I threw the coins for both the people here and also the Gloucester Writers Center as a as an entity. And as will happen sometimes, there's what's called a changing line, which means that you have two hexagrams, one for the present and the other for the future. So the one we got for the present time, this is actually one of the poems that I've memorized. It's called Preponderance of the Small. Long ago, all you see, even the stars were caught in the hunter's basket. The howling and wailing bird brings the message, shall now avail you not to fly into the sun, but find your nest on earth. Small things may be done. And our changing hexagram is Modest Journey Through. And this one kind of is good for this place because it talks about large currents of air, like continental or subcontinental size, like you find from between ocean and land. Warm night has come a distance. Warm ocean, large enough for a whisk of a southern sea wind. Far inland, past coastal plains and hilled crests, lay an evening shard on horizon's bony back, within walking distance, a mountain. Modest possibility, which is too much, reduce, which is too little, augment. Weigh the wealth of Gaia, equal without claims, balanced on the fullness of a heart. So that's my last poems. I'll mention my books and stuff over there. There's a little single, what I call a mini little book, which are free for people to take. It's, it says Ottawa City Blues, I think. And my books I'm selling for $5 a piece. If you have books you want to exchange with me, that's good. I'll go on the honor system. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.